series.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think we're expecting a few more to turn up at some point. Certainly there's a few speakers that are going to come partway through today, and I hope some other delegates too. But I think we should start on time, keep to the programme. So it's 10 o'clock now, and welcome to this two-day conference on philosophy of religions, cross-cultural, multi-religious approaches. Very pleased that you could make it. You probably noticed that there's a rather bigger event going on campus. You might have seen the signs for the International Medieval Congress that are scattered around campus. And maybe there's not ever so many people milling about this time in the morning, but there will be over the rest of this week and later today. And as it happens, it's I think it's the world's largest medieval conference of medievalists, people with expertise and interest in medieval studies. This conference of ours is not part of that, so we're a little sequestered group within that larger milieu, but I just thought I'd mention what else is going on. And that does make for some interest, actually. If you have any time to look around, there's an enormous book display, for example, with various bookstalls in the Parkinson building, which is the big white building with the clock tower on top, and Parkinson Court, the area. I think all this week there are a large number of bookstalls, but only if you've got an interest in medieval studies, I think otherwise it might not appeal. So I'm Mick Burley, as most of you know, and I'm the main organiser of this event. And so it's my pleasure and privilege to introduce it. This first session of mine will be, I thought I'd perhaps say a little bit about my own ideas in a while after just introducing the conference generally. I should say right at the outset that I'm extremely grateful to the sponsors of the conference, of whom there are three. There's Cambridge University Press, who have put up a lot of money towards the conference. They have a particular interest in it because the aim is for at least most of the papers that are being presented here to form the basis of articles that will then be subsequently published in a special issue of the Journal of Religious Studies. We're expecting to have that published sometime in 2020, and Cambridge University Press is the publisher of that journal, so that was one of the main reasons why they were particularly interested in or willing to sponsor conference. Also, the Spalding Trust have put some money towards it, and the Centre for Philosophy of Religion here at Leeds. So I'm grateful to all those institutions. Okay, so rather than present a full paper, I thought I'd say a few things to introduce the theme of the conference, and then offer a sort of summary, an abbreviated version of a paper that I wrote recently that's on a relevant topic. So to introduce the theme of the conference, I'm going to start with three quotations, each of three philosophers of religion that I think characterise different approaches to the philosophy of religion. So I'll read this one out. This is from John Hick, a well-known philosopher of religion who died in 2012. 6 years ago now. This is from his book, Dialogues in Philosophy of Religion, first published in 2001. He says, "It seems clear to me that the philosophy of religion is not properly just the philosophy of the Christian or Judeo-Christian tradition, but in principle of religion throughout history and throughout the world. For the philosophy of religion, on analogy with the philosophy of science, philosophy of law, philosophy of art, philosophy of education, philosophy of mind, and so on, is properly the philosophy of religion, not just of one particular form of it." So although we might have some doubts about the global multicultural reach of those other branches of philosophy that he lists, I think we get the point that he's trying to make, which is that if you're going to engage with the concept of religion, the theme of religion, the topic of religion, then it's not really going to be doing justice to that if you restrict yourself to a very narrow range of religions. Now, he's not necessarily saying that every philosopher of religion needs to be engaging with a broad range of religions, but across the sort of subdiscipline as a whole. That seems to be the suggestion. Now I'm going to contrast that with a passage from a book by Tim Mawson of the University of Oxford, from the introduction to his book called Belief in God, An Introduction to the Philosophy of Religion. Now we might immediately notice from the title Belief in God that there's a certain narrowing of scope there to the subject range, and he makes that explicit in this passage, I think. He says, "If I am to make significant progress in the space allowed by a relatively short book, I must concentrate on an area that I can reasonably hope to traverse in the amount of time such a format allows. So for this reason, which I admit is not a philosophical reason, I'm going to focus exclusively on the main philosophical arguments pertaining to the monotheistic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and to the main claim of these religions, that there is a God." So he's being quite open and explicit. I think that's a good thing. I think it's good to be open about the sort of limitations in the project that one's proposing. But I think it is perhaps symptomatic of a particular approach that's been very prevalent in not just analytic sort of Anglo-American philosophy of religion, but Western philosophy of religion across the board. So contrasts quite starkly, I think, with Hicks, at least Hicks' aspiration. My third quotation is from John Cottingham, who's been a pioneering philosopher of religion over recent years, put out a number of books in which he's explicitly endeavouring to cover a wider range of topics within the philosophy of religion than an exclusive focus on what we might call doctrinal or doxastic or belief-focused elements. So he's promoted what he calls a more humane approach to the philosophy of religion, which endeavours to encompass practical dimensions of religion. But there's a certain limitation noticeable in this passage, this introduction to his book, Philosophy of Religion Towards a More Humane Approach, where he says, "All philosophizing, whether practitioners acknowledge it or not, is inevitably conducted within a given cultural or historical context." I think that's probably unarguable. But then he says, "And this book is no exception, being primarily informed by the philosophical tradition going back to Plato and Aristotle, and the religious tradition whose roots go back to the Judeo-Christian scriptures." So I think, as with Mawson, it's a good thing that Cottingham is being explicit about the starting points and the limitations, the scope of the project he's engaged in. But we might want to say, yes, but there's more too. There's more that could be covered. There's more that can be covered under the heading of the philosophy of religion. And so we ought to be cautious about giving our books titles like Philosophy of Religion Towards a More Humane Approach, or implying that we're providing a very broad-ranging analysis and inquiry into religion in general, if we're then going to be fairly restricted in the scope. So I, for one, am quite keen to contribute to promote a broadening out of the possibilities within philosophy of religion. Again, to emphasise, doesn't mean that every philosopher of religion needs to be looking at the whole range of different religious traditions, but at least to promote that as a possibility within the subdiscipline as a whole. And there's been a lot of people calling for such widening of scope and transformation of the field over recent years. And I thought I'd just mention a few books that have come out since 2008, over the last 10 years. This one, an edited volume, published in 2008, co-edited by David Cheetham, who's going to be joining us shortly today, he'll be speaking later, and Rolf King, who's not joining us. But the edited volume comprises chapters, many of which are from sort of Christian based perspectives, but some from Jewish perspectives, Muslim perspectives, Sikh, Hindu, and Buddhist perspectives. There's a wide range covered there, and it's quite a comprehensive book. And I think our own Mark Gwynne has a chapter in there. Just mention Mark at the back there. And then Tim Nepper, and somebody else who's going to be joining us, I hope, later today, and will be speaking tomorrow. Tim's made a valiant effort to get here. He was at an interfaith conference in Denver over the last few days, and he was due to arrive into Manchester this morning. So hope he's able to join us. His book, The Ends of Philosophy of Religion, Terminus and Telos, came out in 2013. And there, Tim is... He's adopting a critical perspective on both continental European philosophy of religion and analytic Anglo-American philosophy of religion. And he's putting forward what he describes as a five-fold strategy for overcoming certain limitations of scope. I won't go into any of those five dimensions of his approach, but we might hear something about them from Tim himself tomorrow. And then there's a book by Professor Kevin Shilbrack, who's with us at the back there, and will be speaking after me. There's going to be a short break after me, and then Kevin will be the first proper paper at the conference today. And this book by Kevin came out in 2014, Philosophy and the Study of Religions, a Manifesto with Wiley Blackwell. And that's received a lot of well-deserved attention. Reviews and roundtable discussions and podcast interviews and such like, and Kevin is putting forward a threefold critique of what he calls traditional philosophy of religion, what we might call the contemporary philosophy of religion as it's done in the main, and he sort of targets the aspects of narrowness and over-intellectualism and insularity as being some issues, some weaknesses or limitations in contemporary philosophy of religion, narrowness and scope, over-intellectualism in the sense of a fixation on belief or doctrinal aspects and not enough attention to practice or ritual or myth and other things, and insularity insofar as many philosophers of religion, not all, but some have been a little bit reluctant to engage with other branches of philosophy and other disciplines involved in the study of religion. And Kevin puts forward some suggestions for how those limitations might be overcome. 2015, Why Philosophy Matters for the Study of Religion and Vice Versa by Thomas A. Lewis, who's not going to be participating in the conference, but that's a worthy contribution to the discussion as well. Last year, 2017, an edited volume, Renewing Philosophy of Religion, Exploratory Essays, co-edited by Paul Draper, John Schellenberg, also calling for sort of methodological innovation in philosophy of religion. I think it's about 13 chapters in that by different authors, making different claims about the direction philosophy of religion could go in. And earlier this year, Reconfigurations of Philosophy of Religion, Possible Future, adopting a similar sort of project, but in this edited by Jim Canaris, and most of the authors there, most of the contributors, are coming from a perspective largely informed by continental European philosophy, so that gives it a slightly different twist. And also, I wanted to mention the area of what we might call comparative philosophy more generally. And here there's a contribution, well, there have been several contributions by one of our other speakers who's joining us later, Jessica Fraser. This is a book of hers from 2009, Reality, Religion and Passion, Indian and Western Approaches in Hans-Georg, Gadamer and Rupa Goswami. And that's a sort of exercise in comparative philosophy with a religious component, as you can tell from the title, but not exclusively so. And just finally, among this little roundup of some recent books, all of our speakers over the conference have made contributions to the area of the study of religion from a philosophical perspective. So I'm not mentioning them all here, I don't mean to embarrass anybody. But here's this final one, I thought I'd mention it. Victoria did come out only last week, am I right? Came out only last week, I haven't had a chance to read it in full yet. But The Oneness Hypothesis, Beyond the Boundary of Self, co-edited by a number of co-editors, including Victoria Harrison, who's with us today and will be speaking later. And I don't want to do any justice to it, but I gather that what's meant by the oneness hypothesis here is the idea that we find in a number of religious and philosophical traditions that there's a very intimate relationship between the self on the one hand and the cosmos as a whole on the other. And we might describe, or the traditions themselves might describe that relationship as so intimate that it's a unity or a oneness. That captures the basic kind of concept. And so the book is coming from a number of different angles, various contributors looking at that sort of notion in a cross-cultural, comparative religious way. So there's a lot going on, and there have been a lot of calls for changes and a lot of experimental projects endeavouring to develop alternative, transformative approaches in philosophy and philosophy of religion in particular. And what I'm going to do in the remainder of my time, I don't want to go on too long, but I started about 10 and we're going to have a break about 5 to 11. So I'll probably speak to until about 10:45, another 20 minutes or so. And in that time, I want to just share a few ideas from a paper that I've got coming out in the Journal of Cultural and Religious Theory. I think it's going to be in their online edition sometime this year, maybe in the... they've got two online versions of the journal. I think it's going to be one this year and another one next year. And it's a long paper, so I'm going to just summarise some aspects of it. It's got a long title as well. It's not one of my most concise titles. It's called A Language in Which to Think of the World, Animism, Indigenous Traditions, and the Deprovincialisation of Philosophy of Religion. And it's the product of some of my thinking about how philosophers of religion might bring what are traditionally called indigenous religions or indigenous traditions into the discussion of philosophy of religion. So I'm going to read some passages from the from the paper. So the paper begins with a discussion of the concept of animism as it occurs in the anthropology of religion primarily. First deployed in the 19th century by the pioneering anthropologist Edward Tylor, the term animism fell out of favour with many anthropologists by around the middle of the 20th century. This was in large part because of certain pejorative associations it had accrued, such as being associated with a supposedly early or primitive stage of religious development. In more recent decades, however, the concept of animism has undergone something of a revival, having been readopted both by a number of anthropologists who discuss it in ways that avoid the associations with superstition or primitivity, and by some groups such as neo-pagans, especially eco-pagans, who regard animism as a positive self-designation. Then in section two, so in that section one of the paper, I'm sort of trying to talk a bit about that, the way the concept of animism has a history behind it. And then in section two, I discuss the treatment that indigenous religions have received from philosophers of religion. For the most part, they've simply been neglected. On the relatively few occasions when they're mentioned, it's usually for the purpose of stating why they won't be discussed any further. For example, John Hick, despite his ostensibly broad-ranging conception of philosophy of religion, subscribed to a common distinction between the great world traditions, on one hand, and primal, archaic, or pre-axial religions, on the other. While the great traditions operate with a concept of individual salvation or liberation, Hick maintains, the primal traditions are merely concerned with keeping things on an even keel, as he puts it. Since keeping things on an even keel doesn't conform to Hick's conception of religion as engendering a transformation from self-centeredness to reality-centeredness, he leaves the so-called primal traditions aside. A rare book-length study of indigenous religions is Arvind Sharma, A Primal Perspective on the Philosophy of Religion, first published in 2006. Despite having the virtue of at least giving attention to smaller-scale traditions, that have generally been ignored by philosophers of religion. Sharma's book has been criticised on the grounds that rather than looking to see how the ways of understanding the world that are present in the indigenous traditions themselves might reshape or call into question certain prevalent philosophical assumptions, Sharma instead tries to shoehorn his analysis of indigenous religions into the conceptual framework set forth in an introductory textbook by John Hick. So Hick published a book called, just called The Philosophy of Religion, in which he has a fairly standard set of categories, and what Sharma does is take those same set of categories, takes that same set of categories and endeavours to discuss indigenous religions within that context. And he's been criticised for that, among other things, because it doesn't really work very well. Now, a more fruitful example, I think, of a discussion of indigenous religions and specifically of the concept of animism occurs in work by Richard Eldridge, Mario von der Ruhr, and D.Z. Phillips. Eldridge's essay, Is Animism Alive and Well?, was published in 1996 and responded to by von der Ruhr in the same edited volume, a volume edited by D.Z. Phillips, as it happens. And Phillips added his own comments in his book, The Religion and the Hermeneutics of Contemplation, in 2001. And it's from those comments of Phillips that I borrow the phrase, a language in which to think of the world, in the title of my own article. And it's the discussion between Eldridge and von der Ruhr that I take as a principal focus for exploring the topic. Now, the contributions of Eldridge, von der Ruhr, and Phillips are important, I think, in as much as they exhibit ways of avoiding the kinds of hasty marginalisation of indigenous traditions exemplified by Hick and by others. By offering potential points of connection with anthropological literature, these philosophical treatments, while limited in their own ways, open up possibilities of interdisciplinary inquiry that warrant attention and augmentation. Following suggestions from figures such as Wittgenstein and the anthropologist Robin Horton, Eldridge distinguishes between, on the one hand, modern materialist cultures that strive to control nature, satisfy material desires, and cultivate power, and on the other hand, traditional cultures that accentuate, quote, the expression of a sense of human ensoulment and resonance with nature, thus leading to what Horton calls an intensely poetic quality in everyday life, end quote from Eldridge. Eldridge maintains that despite the divergences between these general orientations, the poetic quality retains a place in all human life, such that it may be apt to speak of a natural poetry of being. Eldridge's suggestion that there's something poetic about animistic ways of thinking and behaving echoes suggestions from Brian Clack, who borrows from Goethe the phrase Die Poesie des Lebens, poetry of life, to express the thought that much of what gets derided as superstition may be seen to possess a curious depth, as he puts it. One of Clack's examples, derived from the work of James Fraser, an early anthropologist, is that of the Cambodian King of Fire, who was said by the local community to own a sword containing a spirit who guards it constantly and works miracles with it. The destructive power of the sword is said to be such that the king's unsheathing it, even partially, would result in the sun becoming hidden and people and animals falling unconscious. Withdrawing it from its scabbard completely would bring about the end of the world, reportedly. Commenting on this example, Clack observes that an excessively rationalistic interpretation would assume that a false conception of causality is in play, whereas adopting a different perspective might disclose something deeper. Instead of fixating on the error of supposing that a sword could have such magical powers, Clack recommends reflecting upon, quote, the fascination that envelops us when we entertain the possibility that it might. In doing so, we may come to recognise the essentially poetic nature of such acts. Now, I think Clack, being a bit Wittgensteinianly inclined himself, is not necessarily putting this forward as the correct interpretation of the story or the myth or the practice, but is rather endeavouring to open our minds to more imaginative possibilities than taking it as a straightforward sort of empirical claim about the sword. That would be my reading of what Clack's up to, and I think it's worth considering. Inviting us to perceive certain customs or practices under the aspect of poetry is a means of freeing us from the temptation to dismiss them as products of ignorance or confusion. Just as it would show a misunderstanding to conflate poetic utterances with, say, scientific hypotheses, so, according to the view exemplified by Eldritch and Clack, it would show a misunderstanding of practices imbued with animistic or magical elements to conflate them with straightforwardly instrumental styles of reasoning. What needs to be cultivated by the philosopher or any other interpreter is a sensitivity to the distinctive character of the modes of discourse in question, and, as the anthropologist Irving Halliwell, among others, has urged, an alertness to the dangers of hearing that discourse through the potentially distorting filter of categorical abstractions imposed from outside. Now, in the next section of my paper, headed Beyond Literalism and Metaphor, I discuss how von der Ruhr attempts to supplement Eldritch's discussion by adding some examples of his own. For examples that he derives from an anthology about Native American culture. So von der Ruhr's approach is to adduce various passages from speeches made by Native Americans, which accentuate an attitude of reverence to the natural environment and disgust at its mistreatment by the settlers of European descent. For example, he quotes a Wintu woman's lamentation that, unlike the Native Americans, who never hurt anything, the settlers plough up the land, displacing rocks and felling trees. The trees and rocks protest, "Don't, I am sore, don't hurt me," but the settlers persist in their destructive ways. As a consequence, the spirit of the land hates them. Complementing the Wintu woman's lament is an affirmation by the Stony Indian walking buffalo, that trees talk to one another and to people, providing one is willing to listen. While the trees have taught him much about the weather, animals, and the Great Spirit, the problem with the white people, he says, is that they refuse to listen, whether to Indians or to other voices in nature. If remarks of this sort are heard in the light of a rudimentary division between literal or realist and metaphorical or non-realist meaning, then von der Ruhr argues they're prone to appear, quote, either ridiculous or cheap, saying either too much to be intelligible or too little to convey the meaning intended. They'd appear ridiculous and extravagant if assumed to be asserting that trees and rocks literally, really speak or cry out in pain, just as human beings do. And they'd appear cheap and insubstantial if assumed to be merely metaphorical, but they don't say enough to make clear what the force of the metaphor is supposed to be. Does, for example, talk of listening to the voices of trees come to anything more than the suggestion that one may discern that an animal is nearby or that the wind is blowing by listening to the leaves of a tree rustling? Von der Ruhr admits that the notion of metaphor that's pertinent to the literal metaphorical dichotomy is in itself somewhat narrow, for it presupposes the translatability of metaphors into non-metaphorical terms without loss of meaning. While this may be feasible in the case of some metaphors, it's unlikely to be feasible in all cases. But for the sake of argument, he's willing to go along with that conception of metaphors, since it's the one assumed by those theorists who suppose there to be a basic binary opposition here. Either something is sincerely meant, or it's merely metaphorical whimsy. The third possibility that both von der Ruhr and Phillips want to foreground is that the remarks of Native Americans about trees and rocks and other features of the environment show us something. They reveal a distinctive attitude towards nature in a form of words that could not simply be translated into other terms without falling short of expressing the attitude at issue. Again, in this respect, they're comparable to the words of a poem, not in the sense that they could be dispensed with and replaced by a strictly literal paraphrase, but precisely in the sense that they're indispensable. To quote Phillips again, "We are offered a language in which to think of the world, a language through which we're enabled to comprehend how the earth and trees can be seen as having a certain spiritual status that is internally related to or constitutive of what one takes the earth and the trees to be." What this contention certainly does not entail is that the language or mode of discourse that we're being offered
constitutes a conceptual scheme that's incommensurable with any modern Western way of viewing the world. Mutual understanding between those who speak in animistic terms and those who don't is not being precluded. The point is that arriving at a deep understanding of the words at issue won't be achievable without acquiring far more than a superficial appreciation of the other's perspective on the world. The words themselves provide a point of entry into that perspective, but they must be situated within the broader framework of a form of life. To the extent that we're able to enter into the perspective in question, not in the sense of coming to share it ourselves, but in the sense of coming to see more clearly what it would be to share it, we enrich our appreciation of how the world might be comprehended differently, how different concepts might be adopted, or those that we already have might be embellished or modified. In short, we come to see different possibilities of sense or possibilities of meaning. This is an important goal for philosophy of religion to pursue, not least because it facilitates a deep cultural self-critique, a critical perspective on the taken-for-granted beliefs and values in one's own culture, and on the prejudices through which one may be viewing the world. To fill out the framework in which the animistic talk of Native Americans occurs, von der Ruhr quotes further passages from the anthology upon which he's drawing. I don't have time to mention most of these, but I'll quote one more from a spiritual leader of the Wanapum people named Chief Smohalla. In a passage that's been widely quoted elsewhere, Smohalla protests to his Euro-American persecutors in the following words. Quote, "You ask me to plough the ground. Shall I take a knife and tear my mother's breast? Then, when I die, she will not take me to her bosom to rest. You ask me to dig for stone. Shall I dig under her skin for her bones? You ask me to cut grass and make hay. How dare I cut off my mother's hair?" End quote. We might note in passing that the numerous places where this passage has been quoted include a work of analytic moral philosophy by Angelica Krebs, who cites it to illustrate the position that nature in its entirety is sentient. To refute this so-called position, Krebs observes that the ground does not grow nor tremble when, for instance, farmers plough their fields, just as the sea does not respond in these ways when someone rows a boat upon it. Since then, neither the earth nor the sea displays the requisite behavioural criteria for the correct application of the concept of pain, Krebs concludes, apparently without irony, that, quote, "the claim that either feels pain is thus false." This use of an Amerindian's words, lacking any attempt to contextualise them within the broader worldview of the Wanapum or other indigenous peoples of the Columbia Plateau from which they originate, is not untypical of much Western philosophy. It's precisely this decontextualizing propensity, which demonstrates a tin ear for a language that's religiously or otherwise culturally inflected, that philosophers such as Phillips and von der Ruhr are resisting. For von der Ruhr's part, he goes a long way towards contextualizing certain Native American expressions of an animistic bent by assembling illustrative textual excerpts. By integrating those excerpts into his overall discussion, von der Ruhr effectively does what he accuses James Frazer and others of not doing, namely expounding the grammar of the vocabulary that's employed by the peoples being studied. Still, however, there's room for critical reflection upon the agenda that remains only implicit in von der Ruhr's selection of examples. No such selection can hope to be fully comprehensive, and hence there are choices to be made about, as it were, the story one wishes to tell by means of the examples. It's notable that von der Ruhr's examples of Native American modes of discourse are all derived from a single anthology. Although the compiler of that anthology, Terry McLuhan, has herself gathered the passages from diverse sources, she's patently done so with a specific purpose in mind. As an extract from a review in the Toronto Star quoted on the opening page of the anthology remarks, quote, "It's a religious and poetic work whose object is to draw attention to the lasting beauty and truth of the best of Indian tradition," end quote. And as McLuhan herself admits, this is not a scholarly book. It makes no pretense to academic rigour. We should therefore not expect to find in the anthology a balanced assortment of excerpts, but rather, to borrow a phrase from Wittgenstein, a one-sided diet. In von der Ruhr's selection, the diet becomes even more one-sided, a distillation of a distillation, designed to illustrate the solemn and reverential attitude displayed by many Native Americans towards the environment they inhabit, and with which they feel a deep affinity. There's nothing wrong with seeking to bring out this particular aspect of Native American culture, and hence neither is there anything necessarily suspect about von der Ruhr's choice of examples. A danger of oversimplification and essentialization emerges, however, when the heterogeneity of Native American attitudes and ways of being is lost sight of, and the recognition of plurality is replaced by a monolithic representation. For the Indian, von der Ruhr writes at one point, it was essential to be in close contact with the earth and everything on it, end quote. While this may be a viable starting point for analysis, it's little more than that. And the notion of the Indian that it invokes harbours an implicit idealisation. Some Native Americans themselves have invoked such idealisations, just as they've endorsed a binary opposition between the Indian or the red man on the one hand and the white man on the other. In the words of Vine Deloria Jr., a well-known Lakota author and campaigner for Native American rights, quote, "The Indian lived with his land, the white destroyed his land, he destroyed the planet Earth," end quote. In the light of the sustained persecution suffered by many Native Americans since the arrival of Europeans, the motivation for such pronouncements is understandable, but the language is strategically rhetorical, intended to advance the interests of indigenous peoples against the non-indigenous encroachments. It isn't the language of non-partisan philosophical reflection. And what I do in the next section of the paper is to develop a more nuanced account of Native American cultures and their relation to the natural world by discussing what's become known as the ecologically noble savage debate. That is, the debate over the dangers of stereotyping Native Americans and other indigenous peoples as necessarily ecologically or environmentally friendly in their attitudes and ways of life. But there isn't time to enter into that part of the paper now, since I want to leave some time in case anyone has any questions or comments. So I'll end it there. Thank you very much.